This week's episode was supposed to be a micro episode, but it turned out so well, I've upgraded it to a full episode and tacked on a long overdue listener mailbag segment. So please enjoy. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts Micro. And I think this one's really going to be micro instead of one of those like hour and 10 minute micros that isn't actually, because we don't really have a plan for this one. Binge suggested we talk about our early online gaming experiences. And I can talk about that right now for myself. Okay, there we go. But some of us played online games more than the others. So I thought this would be fun just to do kind of an anecdotal, like, you know, here are my experiences kind of episode. And I can talk about some stuff.
Yeah, got
so anyway, guys, why don't you introduce yourselves? The main culprit here.
Benge Edwards. I am the culprit who wants to talk about online stuff. And yes, what do you want me to say?
I don't know.
Hi, I'm Benge Edwards. I run VintageComputing.com. And I write about computer and video game history. And also network history, BBS history a lot. So
you seem like someone who would be very good to talk about this subject.
Yeah. I mean, I've written about Prodigy and CompuServe and BBSs and the early web and the early internet, and I was involved with a lot of them myself.
Well, there you go. And?
And I'm Ben Elgin. I'm also old, so I was around when this early stuff was happening. And I spent some time on dial-in BBSs, spent some time in early text-based online stuff. So we got a few things we can talk about here, probably.
Cool. And then I am someone who got online in the early 90s and didn't use it to game. I don't know. I feel like it's deficient or something.
Did you have friends to play with?
I think if you're online, you don't need friends. It's just
that's,
there's other
people. Did back then. That's the thing. It wasn't like a matchmaking thing.
Yeah,
you had to have someone to connect to.
Yeah, no, you know, around the time that I was getting into the internet, getting on the internet, I was also getting into role-playing games. You know, if you're into Final Fantasy or something, you're not going to be playing that with someone else. So there just wasn't much online that appealed to me. I played a little bit of locally networked Marathon and Doom.
Yeah. So you were a Mac guy.
Yeah.
Mac guy.
Same online.
We were into first-person shooters a lot, but...
Yeah, in that era, I also did LAN, Marathon, made some of my own, like, Marathon 2 levels.
Nice.
So we actually had one that was based on my undergrad dormitories, all linked together with secret tunnels.
Oh, my God. Are you a school shooter?
Yeah, totally.
You know, 5 years later, you would have gone to jail for
probably,
doing that.
Probably. Mm-hmm. And then, like, a little beyond that, I helped run some Myth tournaments.
So you were a Bungie fan.
I was a Bungie fan.
That's cool.
We've probably talked about that at some point.
Yeah, we need to do a Myth episode at some point.
We should do a Myth episode. I would totally do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my first experience being told to get AIDS and die online.
Neat.
But the
internet's always been so warm and supportive.
But except there was an expectation of having things moderated back then. So, you know, we kicked that guy off and it was all
right. That's true, yeah.
But we're getting way ahead of
what
Bench was
going to
talk about.
Yeah, well, I could go back to my earliest online experiences are from 1992. When I was only 11 years old, my dad brought home a modem, a 2400 baud modem. Yeah, yeah, I'm young. My dad brought home a 2400 baud modem from work one day and said, "Hey, this is a modem. You can connect to other computers with it." And that was actually a little earlier because my brother was calling BBSs, which are bulletin board systems, which are individual systems running special software that people could call and connect to using a terminal emulator program. So it was all text-based, and it was only one person at a time on most of these systems because you would have had to have multiple phone lines to have multiple people calling at the same time. And
so what's a terminal emulator exactly?
Well, a serial terminal is a character-based display, you know, input-output device that was invented to interface with early mainframe computers instead of like a teletype or something. So they had glass terminals that were CRTs instead of paper. And then that became a standard. The serial standard became a standard. And terminal emulators are a piece of software running on a computer that simulate that serial connection.
Oh,
just
I see.
That serial...
Okay.
all the protocols involved with that.
And so
all
you could be at home running like an IBM PC clone, and it would be like you had a virtual VAX. Which
yeah, you could dial into a virtual VAX or
virtual,
whatever.
Virtual access, sure.
Yeah, you could dial into whatever mainframe remotely with a terminal emulator and connect to it as if you were there with the local terminal.
Yeah.
So remotely.
And I was doing this for Mac OS at the same time. So I was in the high school in the mid-90s. We also had a modem starting with a really slow one and getting progressively faster. And there was actually a booming dial-in BBS scene in my area code, just kind of by coincidence. This was outside St. Louis. I think there was a lot of bored suburban white kids setting up their own servers just to have a cool thing that they
ran. A lot of teenagers in my area.
Yeah, yeah.
I called BBSs all summer in 92, and then in November or December, I decided to set up my own BBS, which I called the Cave BBS, and I started that, and I ran that all the way till 98. February 98, when I just wanted to use the internet all the time on my second line instead of hosting a BBS.
Why the Cave? Is that a reference to Plato? Were you running your own Plato terminal?
Yeah, it was a philosophical thing about shadows and how reality is not really what you see. And no, it's actually my handle was Red Wolf. And I figured I picked Red Wolf because my brother's alias online was Blue Dragon, and his favorite color is blue. Mine is red. And so I just picked Red Wolf, I guess. And where does a red wolf live? In a cave,
apparently,
of course.
In a cave.
I see.
This is 11-year-old logic. Okay. You know, I don't think they actually live in caves. And there are real red wolves, which I didn't know at the time. They're endangered, but they're native to North Carolina. And,
I actually thought about setting up my own BBS, but never quite got around to it. I was going to like buy an old like 486 or something to have as a spare and set it up on there. But like I said, my area code was really kind of saturated anyway, so it would have been unnecessary. I think mine was going to be Terminus.
Terminus.
Which was an Asimov reference.
Mm-hmm. I was lucky I had a dad who supported my love of technology, so he let me use a hand-me-down PC as my PBS computer. And I changed them out. Like I had a 286 laptop first, a Tandy laptop, and then he needed to use that again. So then I went to an 8086 IBM PS2 Model 25, which was insanely slow and monochrome and stuff. But it was a free computer, and I had no problem with that. And then I upgraded to 386 and stuff like that. But anyway, so the gaming element.
And as for myself.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
I played console games, so that's
right. Yeah.
Okay. But the gaming aspect comes in on BBSs. It's not a one-on-one thing at that time, usually. It was a sort of time-shifted gaming experience.
Asynchronous. It'd have to be because everyone was dialing in one at a time, so you had to have some setup where you could have people take turns and just come in, and no matter who else had been in recently, and pick it up.
And you had a time limit. You could play and take some turns, and then you'd get kicked off, and the next person could dial up and use it. And so we had games like running on our BBSs, like Trade Wars 2002 was very popular. Later, Legend of the Red Dragon was extremely popular. Let's see, Solar Realms Elite, Global War, Operation Overkill 2. There was even a freshwater fishing simulator, which was really cool. But all these are ASCII text-based and with ANSI graphics, we called them at the time, using the IBM extended character set to make graphical.
Think of them as abstract emoji, basically, in basic geometric shapes. And so you could end up having a program draw rudimentary pictures just by using these shape characters. Mm.
Yeah, so we loved those games, and they have more depth than a lot of modern games. I still play Trade Wars 2002 every once in a while. Every few years, I get back into it, because I still run a BBS. Since 2005, I think I've run a Telnet BBS. It's a cavebbs.homeip.net port 23, if you want Telnet there.
I would. I'm curious to see. Like, do you have some maybe?
Yeah, we should put this in the show.
ASCII nudes.
Yeah, ASCII nudes. Wait, I used to on my first BBS a long time ago, I think. But everything was so tame back then. It's so funny what we thought adult. Yeah. What we traded was adult. Was like mostly bikini pictures, and there's some, you know, so a couple of Playboy scans.
One of the first huge like two screen ASCII art pictures that I ever downloaded was actually. I mean, it was a bikini picture, but I didn't know at the time it was actually Lum from RSA Atsura. Just a digitization of one of her standard like character portraits, which we totally need to do an episode on. But
yes, okay.
focus on gaming or nudes? I don't
know. Well, let's go back to the
games. Let's go with games.
Trade Wars, I feel like, was really the ubiquitous one. Like, everyone had Trade Wars set up.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
Trade Wars. 2002 was the best version. There was an earlier Trade Wars that wasn't 2002.
I'm assuming it was 2002 is like...
The year 2002. Cause
but that's not the year it came out in, right?
No, it came out like... 89
sure. Okay. Just making sure. Like, yeah, I wanted to be sure. Like, future, we're calibrated to the right time zone here.
Yeah, that was wildly in the future somehow. Mm-hmm. Even though it was only 15 years away or whatever. But
I mean, when I was in third grade, which was like mid-80s, I remember we had a drawing assignment where we had to draw what we would look like in the year 2000, mm-hmm. and almost everyone in the class drew themselves as like old people with beards on the moon. I was like, I'm going to be 24, 25. Uh-huh. So I drew myself like, you know, just a bearded adult instead of an ancient man.
Old people with beards on the moon.
The year 2000, like when you said it, that in the 80s, it was just like, that's so far away.
Yeah.
I'm like, crap, now we're actually further away on this side of the year 2000 than we were when I drew that picture. Yeah. So, geez.
Yep. I think we inherited a little bit of that futuristic. Like in the 50s when my parents were little, they were like, the year 2000, what are we doing? Flying cars. Yeah, and then, it became that. So, we were supposed to be exploring space deeply in different sectors in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
That did not come to pass.
Yeah, I know. Didn't pan out.
But, if you want to know about Trade Wars, it's a turn-based strategy game where you pilot your own ship from sector to sector. A sector is just a discrete unit of space where you go different areas, and there are ports where you can trade. You buy, there's usually three things, and I forgot what they are, like hydrogen and... I don't know. I played it so many times that I can't think of it right now.
It sounds a lot like Star Control 2, but I'm assuming much more simplistic in terms of presentation.
Yeah, you see a text display of what sector you're in. You are in Sector 5. These are the exits to the different sectors. If there's a port there or any ship,
there's nothing visual to it at all, right? It's almost like a text adventure that's happening in multiplayer real-time space.
Except there are graphical splash screens. When you go to the starport and you can go watch a movie to pay some credits to watch an animated antsy movie where they make fun of Star Wars.
Okay.
And then there's a picture of an alien
of the times,
and some pictures of the ships you want to buy that are just block drawings in ANSI.
Mm-hmm.
And you try to buy low and sell high, essentially. And then you build up, you can build planets and upgrade your ship and buy a better ship and blow up other players' ships if they're
okay. So it's kind of like Mule, actually.
No, I wouldn't say it's like Mule at all.
It didn't have the resource management and that sort of thing.
It doesn't feel like Mule. It does have trading and stuff. But there's not. Not a resource management game. It's just mostly a trading game. There are others like Silver Realms Elite and Baron Realms Elite were resource management simulators where you ran a kingdom or a planet or something and you had to manage that.
Yeah, pretty much all of these games would be basically like text presentation but with some illustrations. And you have to remember like a lot of the times people were connecting to these things on like 1200 baud modems, which means you're only getting hundreds of characters a second. So there's not much you can do in terms of graphics. But you can send over like a character illustration every once in a while, or maybe some ones in sequence to be a little animated section. But the interface is all going to be text.
So it's line by line, scrolling up off the screen as you play. Yeah. Usually there are some that manipulate the ANSI escape sequences, which are the characters sent to a terminal to position the cursor on the screen. They manipulate them to have a static screen and you can kind of walk around in it. Like Legend of the Red Dragon 2 does that. Operation Everkill 2 kind of does it. It just scrolls, but it keeps the same position on the screen and makes it look like you're walking around on the map a little bit.
We would even do those things just when posting. So the BBSs would have these, they would call them door games, because they were sort of the attraction to get people in and you could play them. But it was also, as the acronym implies, a bulletin board system. So the other big thing that happens is you just, it's like a forum. You have all these boards. You can post on them. Only one person can actually be dialed in at a time, so it all moves a lot slower. But you could pull these same tricks on a lot of the boards in the actual forum post, so you could embed characters in your post that would cause the cursor to back up and go back forward. So you could make little weird animations. You could have a kind of semi-animated signature or something where it would type something and delete it and type it again. to pull these little weird animation tricks.
We did that
tricks,
later on the mush. There's a multi-user simulated hallucination.
Yeah, I want to talk about those too, because I spent a lot of time in those.
We isolated the ANSI escape character sequence somehow, got it from some object illicitly. This is like a virtual world. This is like Second Life in text, a mush, like a mud where you can build anything you want. And so we somehow got control of this one character. It's the escape sequence. And we could append anything to it to do anything we want to manipulate someone's character. So we figured out a way on the who list of who's connected, you could write a message after your name that shows what you're doing, they call it. So we put a message there that would back up and erase our name off the list.
Is this where the caret H, caret H, caret
yes,
H thing comes
that
from?
That is exactly where that comes
that's
from.
That's something that I saw when I just first started like looking at Usenet and reading fan fictions and things like that. And I would see that.
Yeah,
and
so
it took me a long time to realize that's like an escape character.
Caret H is delete.
Yeah,
right. So if you see someone, if you see a post typed out that has like a word and then a bunch of caret H's.
It's basically at this point someone saying, I am very old and still think in terms of BBS.
But so if you sent that sequence to an actual BBS, it would actually, when you read that post, because again, on a slow modem, you would see these characters coming over in real time. It wouldn't just be the screen appeared all at once. And so you would see this word type out and then delete and then retype something else.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, if things were moving fast enough, you could make it look like an animation, or you can just do silly things where you were saying something and then saying something else instead.
Yeah. Control sequences could put your cursor anywhere on the 80 by 24 column screen.
Yeah. If you
or,
got kind of fancy
you know,
it.
Change the text to blinking or colors or, you know, ring a bell, control G.
Depending on what was
and
supported.
Line feed is control J, I think, and all that stuff. So
yeah, it's all coming back to me.
Yeah. Control H is delete. I know that. But so that was the fun part of BBSing. There's lots of games where there were role-playing games on there, like Operation Overkill 2 is a favorite. Legend of the Red Dragon was neat. I didn't like it that much, but everyone else loved it. And you took turns and you battled and grinded your character up. And is there anything you want to add to that?
We could talk forever about BBS.
I want to talk about
mushes and muxes and muds more because I spent a whole summer on those. Yeah. So
You guys just keep talking. This is one of the rare instances where I've come into a Retronauts and I don't know really anything aside from secondhand information, third-hand information about stuff. So this is really interesting. Thank you.
Sure.
I don't get to have this experience often.
So let's back up on this one. So I think MUDS was probably the first variant of it. So a multi-user dungeon, but then it kind of, not all of them were like combat focused. So it sort of mutated into MUX, which is multi-user experience, or Bench was saying MUSH, multi-user shared hallucination. Is that what that was?
Yeah, but it's like a backronym. It's MUSH is just a play on MUD and MUD.
Okay.
So
what these were is basically interface wise, if you think about something like Zork, right? So your basic text adventure where you have a bunch of locations, you can navigate between them, you can pick up and put down objects, you can interact with maybe some other like NPC actors. And it's all text presentation. So these were like that, but online, and a lot of them gave the players the ability to edit the environment. Mm-hmm. I spent a whole summer in a MUX where you could just basically like stake out a spot within this game world and like build your own stuff. You could build your own, there were commands to basically let you edit the game as you were in it. And so you could build your own environment, build your own objects, and they usually had some kind of scripting language, so you can even have objects interact back with you. You could and the one I was on, we could build vehicles that you could get into and then navigate while you were in the vehicle.
Make NPCs, a lot of vehicles, build houses, build crazy things.
Yeah.
Secret labs.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
I've connected to a mush the first time in 1994 through NC State's data switch, where they had they had a free dial-up service for people to try to – it was really to call in to check their email sometimes or check the library catalog. But through the Gopher system, which was a protocol that predated the web of menus, you could navigate it through to get to a Telnet interface somehow. My friend figured out how to get to a way to Telnet to these mushes that were on a different Gopher somewhere else.
Wait, you could use Telnet – through Gopher?
Yeah, they're all linked together. Because it's all on this text-based terminal. It was all text-based.
Right.
So
I would just Telnet directly. But
I didn't have that ability. This was free. You weren't supposed to be able to type in anything, go and do anything you want. We had to use these backdoor tricks.
So
we figured out a way to a mush. And man, me and my friend, when I was 13 and he was 15, and we spent all summer, all day, all night on that thing. building and programming game, you know, our own worlds. We'd build our own houses. We'd build our own cars that functioned in this text environment. Mm-hmm. Everything you're seeing is descriptions, like your car comes into the room, your car leaves. You know, you're in the library. It has all the, it has a description. You have 100 books and the floor is shiny or something, you know, and there are exits. You go into different rooms and there's an inventory like in Zork and other things. That's part of its MUD heritage.
Yeah, all the basic text adventure infrastructure was there.
Yeah.
And, so, and the other thing about these is these were usually hosted like on a mainframe somewhere. So as opposed to being in BBS where you just had one person tying up the phone line and dial in, you could actually have multiple people telnetted into the system at the same time. So you could actually have, it really was where you could.
Hence the name multi-user.
Hence the name multi-user.
So, the BBS games were solo, single-player games.
Single user,
asynchronous. Yeah.
Right.
So, so they weren't necessarily single-player. They could be multiplayer, but they were always asynchronous. You would log in and take your turns, and then other people would log in and take their turns, and it would tell you when you got back.
There are exceptions. People will point this out, anyone who listens, that there were multi-line BBSs, especially later in the 90s when that became cheaper. There were games like you could play Trade Wars in real time with people flying around, but that wasn't in the golden era, usually.
Yeah, because this was usually being run by teenagers on their parents' secondary line, and most people didn't have more than one second landline.
Yeah, and you had to tie up your entire computer to do this, and they weren't cheap. So a lot of people didn't have a... You were letting them use your computer, you know, just to run BBS to do this. But on the MUSH, the first MUSH I connected to was run on a $30,000 HP workstation that had 32 megs of RAM. Like, I don't know, like
32.
That was
huge.
Yeah. And it was, I don't remember the processor. It was under 100 megahertz or something like that. Yeah. But it was an expensive thing to have all these people running. It required a lot of power at that time to have them connect. And one of the problems with the early MUSHs was people would build so much and they would keep the database of the objects built in RAM. And then they would build too much and they'd run out of memory and then they'd crash. And
especially if you, I mean, yeah, there were a lot of ways that because this could go wrong with the, because the scripting languages would be fairly flexible. So, you know, you could, if you built a thing that when you did something, it made other things.
You yeah,
know,
you could recursively,
you could
crash
basically,
things,
you could basically, you know, gray goo your game world.
Yeah, they had recursion limits and these function invocation limits to try to prevent you from overtaxing the system. And they would make it so it costs real-world money. It costs in-world money.
Yeah, you have a resource.
Credits
to
actually run your programs a little bit. Mm-hmm. So there is a limit to it and to build objects and things. But, you know, I have been BBSing every day since 1994. I mean, not BBSing, mushing. I run a mush since 2000. It's almost 20 years old. Can't believe it.
Wow.
That one I don't give out because it's sort of a private hangout.
Sure.
I have friends that are for the last 20 years that we talk to each other like IRC kind of chat, even when we're not, I don't build much anymore.
You guys ever going to move to Slack?
No. Nah. So Slack is,
I'm totally joking.
Yeah, but I mean, I actually thought about that. It's like, what if you built something like Slack with a MUSH?
Yeah, because I mean, it supports bots and things.
It's sort of like it in a way. But,
I wonder if people have used Slack's functionality to create some sort of virtual game. I just use it to like coordinate with Retronauts people and Fangamer, but
I'm sure there's like bots that'll do simple games because people do bots for like, you know, rolling dice and stuff to facilitate like online D&D sessions and stuff. So I'm sure people have done more complicated ones that can that can moderate their own sort of game.
Never really considered that. But. Ever watched the AMC series? It wrapped up earlier this year, Halt and Catch Fire.
No, but
because like the closest I've ever come to these MUD experiences. And I feel like just listening to you guys talk, it was clearly written by people who had authentic experiences. I mean, it's a little bit Hollywooded up. At some point, they basically create Habitat in 1985, which even Lucasfilm Games couldn't make happen in 1988. But like, you know, they're starting a business. And it's, you know, kind of how it evolves over the course of the 80s. and a lot of like mudding and mushing and these asynchronous online games, like that factors in really heavily. And I'm really curious to hear what you guys think about it if you ever get to see it.
I haven't watched it, but the producers of that show asked me on two different occasions for equipment or something. Nice. Like that.
Wow. But okay.
I didn't, like right when it was starting and then some other seasons later. But at first I gave them a tip about some of it. And then I think they were going to try to rent some from me, but they're like, oh, we turned it. Turns out we don't need it. I spent like 3 months rigging, like wrangling up PCs for them and stuff for their last season or something. But
people are slackers.
Yeah, fell through. So anyway, so I haven't watched it, but I heard it's good, you know.
It came out in another episode, didn't it, too? Because they talked about like TI and that.
Yeah.
I can't watch. I have this weird purity of memory thing where I don't want to watch fictional portrayals of history. Since I write about this history all the time, I don't want any of that getting muddled in my head.
Yeah, like, I can understand that. But I feel like more than any other show I've ever seen or movie or anything I've ever seen about that period of computer history, like they really, for the most part, get it right. And there's been very little about it that I've just kind of said, man, this again. It's not like, you know, Sandra Bullock hanging out on a beach, getting on the internet in 1988. Or like Mission Impossible where Tom Cruise goes on to Usenet and is like, Max.com, gotta find Max.
But that's totally fake. But it's worse when it's almost real, because then my mind might be like, when I'm trying to recall a memory, I'm like, hey, you remember that time they invented Habitat in 1985? You know what I mean? So if you do this all day long for 12 years, you need like some compartmentalization.
I don't read
a lot of other people's history work because I don't want to, you know, pick up a bad fact and repeat it. Mm-hmm. That happens a lot with people. So I want to originate.
So I've
got
to try harder to get my bad facts into your world.
Well, it just depends. Sometimes, you know, I can't. It just depends on, you know, I've spent a long time writing about online history and stuff and that early games. I have my little corner that I try to, you know, keep pure and everything else. Like if I'm going to like Sega or Nintendo stuff that I don't know about, I'm happy reading about it from somebody else, you know. Mm. But anyway, that's an aside. But the online gaming, I was going to talk about, we played modem-to-modem games on PCs, me and my friends that I met on BBSs. There were some where you could play checkers or something against each other, or simple board games, just dial one computer to another through the regular phone system, modem-to-modem. And then eventually Doom came out, which was a revelation because it had... Not only you could deathmatch, which a lot of people did, but we loved to play through the game co-op. We'd play two people playing through the whole story together, side by side, and that was really awesome. I spent a lot of time doing that. And
did you have to use Duango to get online?
No, I just had my friend's phone number. Duango was to help you hook up with people across the country through a different network. You know, they had their own kind of. I think they rented a.
I didn't realize you could do that. Peer-to-peer with Doom.
Yes, you could do direct connection, they call it. You could even do a serial cable between two machines if you wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, I knew about the LAN functionality. I just
but
didn't
not
realize
even
it worked
a LAN,
online.
Just a serial cable. Oh, okay. That's what I'm saying.
And like then, when you wanted to fight against someone with Bushido Blade on PlayStation.
Yeah, that was on the... It's cool on the PlayStation where they had the link cable. You could play co-op Doom with the link cable, and on the Jaguar you could do that.
Some
really
of Bungie's really early stuff had the early connection stuff too. Like, didn't Minotaur had some weird connecting functionality, I think.
I'll tell
you. You know, I have two PVMs and two PlayStations.
Yeah, you should
do that. I need to get you guys over and we can like actually have a Bushido Blade first person match.
I would
do that.
I would love that. Yeah.
My second PS1 is a PS1, like the little one, so that might not work, but I'm sure one of you guys.
I don't know if it has a link port, but I have two PlayStations, ones or three.
Okay.
I don't know.
I might have one, but I'm not sure.
Not
if
the
it works.
PS. I have a PS1, the little white one, but I have some gray ones too.
Man, that would be.
I'm pretty sure I have the original PSX somewhere, but I'm not sure if it's working.
All right.
It'd be fun.
That's totally an aside, but that would be really cool.
At my birthday party about 10 years ago, I got my brother to bring over his GameCube, and we linked up Mario Kart, Double Dash. Mm-hmm. And we actually got, I think, 8 people playing, which was really fun. But although it was tiny on these, I had a second monitor that was small, so it split the screen. But it's neat networking functionality.
Yeah, you know, I remember when the original Halo came out. It was like a really big deal in the media.
Yeah,
the press really loved it. But I just remember reading it and thinking, like, well, they're raving about the multiplayer, but who the hell can do that? Who can actually hook up you know, TVs and Xboxes together in the same space. Like, if you work in the press, sure, you can do that in an office. Like, that actually made me angry at the time. And I was like, I will never write for the games press. I'm going to be independent all my life. I would never work for a magazine like that. Well, the things we do for money.
But, yeah, I mean, people really did, you know, bring over 8 Xboxes and do that sort of thing. But, I mean, we, like back with, like, Marathon, we would just take over the computer lab and, you know. There was already a room with 30 computers in it, so we'll just go down there after hours and we would play Marathon too.
A lot of Marathon Infinity co-op and competitive when I was working on my university newspaper.
So you do have early online experience.
Well, no, it wasn't online. It was within the LAN at the university.
Well, it's close. It's networking.
It was like the dude 2 computers down from me.
I know, but it's kind of networking. It's the same principle, but it's not remote.
If you can, like, throw something at the head of the person who's just shot you, like, no, that's not online.
Well, it's the same principle.
Online is empty threats of violence.
You're using the same protocols, but you're just there instead of somewhere far.
Yeah, but it's still a different experience. I mean...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying. My brother had, you know, he went to NC State, and they had computer labs, and they would play all these LAN games and stuff. Some of them were on Unix machines. They weren't even Doom. Yeah. But I was going to say, Doom 1 had four-person deathmatch you could do over a LAN, over IPX network. And at this company I worked for, at nighttime, the engineers would go there. They had a link together network. They would play Doom together. So I think that happened to a lot of companies with LANs. It wasn't a lot of people bringing up their all computers together.
In college, I worked at a phone book company doing advertisements at night. And one of the guys that I knew from college got me that job there. So there were some nights where we would play stuff like Minotaur and so forth on the company machines, which we shouldn't have been doing. But I guess it didn't really matter because we didn't get paid by the hour. We got paid by the ads. So, you know,
it's all good.
It was us shooting ourselves in the foot, basically. It wasn't taking away from company hours.
By the way.
Yes.
Last year I wrote a slideshow for PC Mag called 7 Early Modem-to-Modem Computer Games.
Nice.
Which is really neat. I tried to track down the earliest.
Earliest
games that actually advertised the fact that you could call someone with a modem and play them directly.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the earliest is Telechess for the Apple II, 1984.
Yeah.
And then there's others like this version of Trek in 85. There's this crazy one, American Challenge, a sailing simulation on Mindscape. That. You could actually
like vector graphics.
Yeah, but it's insanely complicated. I've played this on my Tandy.
Is that
1000.
A fishing game?
No, it's a sailing game, like yacht racing.
A big one.
I'm suddenly getting this flashback to some sailing game on Apple II. I'm not sure if it was that one, but man.
It might be. It does say Apple II port. It may have been originated on that. But I played on the Tandy 1000.
Please tell me that it had a soundtrack of like 8-bit yacht rock. Yeah,
it did. Definitely.
So I didn't play games online just because the games that I was interested in weren't really the kind of games you played online. Like, I dabbled a little bit in LAN death matches, but even that's not really my thing. Like, I like story-driven, solitary, first-person shooters. And that's fine. But, you know, my online gaming experiences in the early 90s were all about, like, the communities. You know, initially getting online and, like, I would say early 94, getting on the web to the very, very sad early version of the web where it was just, like, a page of text and here's, like, a small 60 by 60 pixel inline image of like the cover of a King Crimson album or something.
Gray background. And
yeah. Like,
change it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like Netscape 1.0.
Yeah.
But, you know, within that space, you started to see fan sites, you know, other people who were interested in the same things as me. You had to go to like link aggregators and find links to these things because there was no real
web
search
rings.
Engine. Yeah. Yeah. Well, before web rings,
before
even
web rings.
Just like,
yeah,
just like lists of
Yahoo
pages.
Was just a directory
of
pages.
Yeah, but you know, I would find things like Final Fantasy Towns, which I know mentioned on the show before, but
Elucia?
And Abilene and what was the other one? There was a third one.
But they
were all just like I feel like they were sort of inspired by Muds and Mushes.
Yes.
Like the idea of a website that was a place and this was before web forums.
Yeah, there were
and
a few
like
connected
that.
Locations with NPCs and stuff, you things.
Like, here's an experience where you are in a town that was taken straight from Final Fantasy III, but it's my town and everyone says their own thing.
Yeah, there's definitely a through line from the Mush experience to this.
Like hearing you guys talk about this, I'm starting to make some connections that I didn't realize, because there was this whole, you know, Usenet BBS thing that I was not fully aware of when I first got online. Like, my first internet experience was the World Wide Web. And I, like, again, I want to say early 1994 when I was just getting into college and my professors were like, there's this new thing, World Wide Web, it's going to be big, you should check it out. And I started working at the university newspaper doing ad design. And, you know, we had one computer. It was like a super beefy Quadra. And it was like super powerful at the time. Not quite PowerPC, but in better than a PowerPC.
The Quadras were the top of the line for a while.
And so that had like its own T1 line in a private office next to the computer lab.
Nice.
So I would just like sit in there after hours and be like, wow, internet, there's all kinds of stuff. So my online experiences initially for gaming weren't really gaming, but they were just kind of like absorbing information and seeing that, oh, there are other people who enjoy these things that I've started to like, and I don't know anyone in real life who likes them.
But other
people do, and I don't feel so alone anymore.
The advent of the web there was when I had to change my online handle, because on the BBS days I was Bahamut. From Final Fantasy, the big dragon that shows up all the time. And once I got on the web, that name was taken way too often because it was too popular. So that's when I switched to Kirin, which was a lesser known song from Final Fantasy VI, which is where it originally came from.
You didn't go with Starlet?
I did not go with Starlet.
Or,
but yeah, I ended up with, and it was in some of those Final Fantasy online communities.
That's what I had the same experience. I think everybody did who got on the web who had a niche hobby or something. But I had a website that had a list of resources about classic gaming, we called it at the time. Not this before retro gaming was a term, and vintage computing and stuff. And it was on Yahoo's directory for vintage computing. Like, it was one of the sites, you know, one of the 100,000 sites that knew about it or whatever.
You were lucky enough to be on Yahoo.
I had a fan page for an obscure character from Ranma 1/2. Which was on the anime web Turnpike.
let me guess which character this was.
Oh,
was it Tsubasa?
No, more obscure than that.
Wow, Gosenkuji,
Akari.
Which one is that?
That was the girlfriend that introduced
the pig,
for Ryoga.
The pig, yeah,
yeah.
Wow. Well, she wasn't even in the English manga at that point, the anime.
The English manga
way
never
ahead
heard
of the curve.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't even
damn
know.
Son.
So I would like to say a word about influences that you mentioned earlier, which is,
yeah, I do. Mm-hmm.
It turns out when we think about the past like it is today, and we think about everyone using computers, but at the time in the 80s and 90s, it was an extremely small group of people. And so that group of people originally, when it, you know, first they all worked together at one company like DEC or something, and then they all split up into these Silicon Valley companies, and they worked together, and then they spread, and then they worked together, and they spread, and all these ideas were shared for mushes and muds and things and BBSs. Every single online game made was influenced by those things that came before, because everyone played them and knew what they were.
It was much smaller
world.
Small
community,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like this episode is being recorded the same week that my interview with Robert Woodhead, Animego, previously of Surtek, one of the, you know, the programmer of Wizardry, just went online. And he talked about the Plato system of the 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once I heard him talk about that and started reading about it, I was like, this is like the incubator of computing right there. Mm-hmm. So much came out of Plato.
Plato is incredible, yeah.
I wish I could go back in time and just check out a Plato system. Yeah. He said it had like a 512 by 512 plasma screen display. Like, who did that in the 70s? That's
crazy. It's insanely advanced. And so that was sort of isolated historically.
Sure.
Because it was in Iowa or Minnesota or something.
It was in Chicago.
Chicago,
Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, so you know, a lot of the Silicon Valley guys didn't know Plato, but if they had, boy, things would have advanced a lot faster. It was a pocket of innovation that's incredible.
Right, but I mean, it still had a big influence it on did. You know, people more the on people the East who Coast, knew Midwest.
It. Yeah, the people who knew it, you know, they carried that with them.
And on the West Coast, you had Xerox PARC, which was, you know, just as much of an incubator of innovation and, you know, creative ideas.
They had the first networking, some of the first network games there, and the Alto and stuff like that.
I mean, that one's a lot better known just because it segued straight into the Silicon Valley companies, so it always gets talked about.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it depends on who writes the history and what history you read and it's what you hear. I've found that myself. Just, you know, you can come along with a new story and it just sort of upsets someone's narrative of how history develops.
Yeah, but I mean, it does seem like, you know, in the early days of computing, there were these little tide pools all sort of isolated. And then, you know, as computers began to spread, you know, it's like the tide came in and all of a sudden there's all this filtration
analogy.
Thank you.
I like it. Yeah.
I'm a writer.
It's like Boston.
I'm glad that I can occasionally
Illinois.
Come up with a good metaphor.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, the tide pool.
It works.
Tide came in. So I'd like to talk about console gaming. First online console gaming.
Yeah.
But online console gaming. There were early.
So you're talking about Nintendo's stock market system. I have one of those Famicom online systems downstairs.
Yeah, I've always wanted one.
Which I got specifically because it has a really good controller, which I think is supposed to be supported by the analog NT.
The button?
A number pad on it.
Yeah, cool.
Nice.
Yeah, like I have no use for the online component of it, but the number pad, you know.
That's awesome.
Like I think the analog NT is supposed to be supporting that for things like Intellivision and ColecoVision.
If you type in numbers in Super Mario Brothers, do you get to go do whatever you want?
No, you don't. I got 99 lives. You press the crown button.
Debug
my secret. So there were early online gaming experiments in the 80s with consoles with the Intellivision had like a cable modem. That's crazy. There's some dial-up modems, you know. There's the Sega channel.
Yeah, there's like a download service for Intellivision,
yeah, there's
I think.
Game Line for the 2600 or something. I don't know if they did head-to-head gaming was, I'm sure there was some precursor and I've probably already written about it. But the first, you know, I'm telling you, there's so much stuff I can't remember everything.
I forgot more about video games than you even know.
Than you ever knew. Yeah. I mean, I just accidentally, while I was Googling that seven head-to-head modem games, I just typed in Benj Edwards modem, and that was a mistake because it was too much stuff. Anyway, so X-Band is what I'm getting to. Was my first.
Heard of that one.
Yeah.
I don't know, 94, 95, something around there, 96 even.
Okay, but for Super NES or Genesis?
Super NES.
Okay.
But I played Killer Instinct against somebody and something else. But it wasn't that great of an experience because they kicked my ass quickly and it cost money for the service and you couldn't play very many games on it.
How was the lag on it? Like,
it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
But it was a revelation because
it just seems like a fighting game. Like you need some pretty quick response in order to not lose sync on something like a fighting game.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised it was good enough for that.
They did. I think Mortal Kombat 2 was supported or something. But it was just a neat, it was the first really mainstream push at putting a modem on a console. There's something earlier that I did in a retro scan that was almost like teleplay modems, Baton teleplay. They wanted to do that for the NES and Genesis earlier, but it never came out.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff that happened in Japan. I mentioned there was
Teleview or
On Famicom you had the I don't know exactly what it was, but it was like that device I have, which has no value now, but you could get online and check your stocks and things like that. And then, the Satellaview came out and that was a download service that predates X-Band.
But it also had like some real-time components.
Yeah,
right?
If you were
playing your
game at
the right time.
So you could download games, like a different game each month and save it on your flash card. But there were also broadcast games.
Yeah.
And I know the most famous one is Zelda.
Right.
And there were three or four Zelda games, like chapters.
Well, it's like installments, yeah.
Yeah, and like they only broadcast, I think, twice each. Mm. And for like 1 hour, there would be like a live navigator actually giving out instructions, you know, calling out instructions live through the network. And you would play the game and follow their instructions and try to like race other players.
That's cool.
Kind of like almost like a precursor to Four Swords, but you know, in a different sense.
And yeah, they had a real-time element with a clock, too.
Yeah, I've heard about people talking this about as, like, you know, one of the most difficult sort of retro games to preserve. Because you have to both have the code for this game that was downloaded, and then the sequence of real-time events that was going on.
Some of the broadcasts have been captured to VHS.
I've seen people recreate them.
But not all of them.
Yeah, but...
So, yeah, that is, like, that's kind of, like, next-level online, or, you know, game preservation.
Yeah.
That's a... It was only one way, though. It wasn't a two-way system.
Right, no, right. It was just being sent out to the...
The Satellaview did have leaderboards and things like that, and you know, so
yeah, so you could send back.
Yeah,
scores.
I've got like
probably had a. If there's a way to send back scores, it probably did it through a phone with a modem or something.
Yeah, yeah,
it was, you know, you can't do an uplink satellite thing from your house.
I mean, it might have been a different setup in Japan. I don't know exactly, but I've got the game Samegame, or Same Game if you prefer.
Yeah.
And that has like interchangeable cartridges that you can plug into the actual cartridge to change out your character maps. But it also had Satellaview support, and you could upload your scores to a leaderboard.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, that's just one of the neatest little side views there. That's one of the things where we talked about. I mean, I don't know if I feel like I talked to Frank Cifaldi about this, where we were talking about how if. You know, this is one of my themes. I wrote an article about this a long time ago. If people hadn't illicitly preserved these things, they would be lost now.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
So we depend on piracy. I wrote an article called Why History Needs Software Piracy in 2012 that was really big. And it was talking about how, you know, it turns out these people backing up these games to copy them for selfish reasons actually did everyone a huge service by preserving them too and categorizing them and also later raising interest in them. Again. And so, yeah, Satellaview is one of those things that would definitely have been lost completely without the illicit backups and copies. Yeah.
And, you know, the corporations, the copyright holders are happy to let these things vanish because they don't have any monetization value now. Yeah. Like, you can't make money off a Satellaview broadcast now, so who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
Nintendo doesn't care. Mm-hmm. All they care about is don't steal our copy of Zelda.
Yeah,
but they don't care about making that Zelda experience available to people now, which is a shame.
It's all about normalizing video games as cultural experiences that are on the level of movies and TVs and operas and whatever. That's what I've had to do from the beginning. I've been preaching this it's accepted now. 10 years ago, it wasn't so much. I got a lot of people like, they're just games. Nobody cares, but these are the experiences of a whole generation. It becomes a seed, one of the ingredients in the recipe of the person that makes you who you are.
I mean, if you look at classic rock bands, there are bands that have just made hundreds of albums available of concert recordings. You know, like they took the soundboard from their concert in Chicago in March 1976. And you can listen to that soundboard recording. And then they have one, you know, they released an album from a month later in Duluth. And you can listen to that one. And they're, you know, like the same set list, but there are differences.
Yeah.
And so, you know, everyone from King Crimson to Pearl Jam to, of course, the Grateful Dead. Like, you know, they have all these albums available that, you know, like the really hardcore fans can listen to pretty much every possible concert recording of the band that they love. So, you know, like the idea of obsessing over, you know, preserving these experiences, this, you know, this artistry is not something that video game fanatics invented. And I don't think video game fans are wrong to want to be able to enjoy that sort of experience. But, you know, game companies haven't decided to capitalize on these forgotten experiences the way bands have.
Yeah, there needs to be a period after which you have a blanket. What's that term for like you forgive everyone at the same time?
Amnesty.
Amnesty, yeah.
Well, copyright shouldn't last 90 years for one thing. It should last like 20 years. Yeah.
But I think there should be a cultural amnesty on copyright for cultural reasons, because I think that when a person consumes media, it becomes, and once you publish it, it becomes like a part of your culture that can't be extricated from it without doing damage, like a gear in a machine. That's the way I would put it.
I feel like
it belongs to everyone in a certain way.
I feel like the original Super Mario Brothers should be open, you know, open available now. It should be public domain.
Speaking of which, was it the 20th or the 30th of Super Mario Brothers 1? I was about to write that they should release the source code for it or something. I asked John Carmack about it because I was going to do an article or something. He's like, well, somebody already disassembled the whole thing, and you know, it's pretty much open source already. Right. There's not a lot to see.
Yeah, but that's an exception.
Things have been slowly getting better. I mean, it's still all about what the companies think they can actually get money from, but at least the companies are starting to think about now things that can be re-released in other formats.
Yeah, but I mean,
as opposed to the, you know, there was an era where you know, a company would finish with a game and just like throw it all out. Mm-hmm. There's whole games where all the source code, all the design docs were just, you know, tossed out in an office move because no one cared.
I own a Blu-ray of Blade Runner that has 5 different versions of the movie available for you to watch. There's like the crappy Harrison Ford narration version. There's like the Ridley Scott, this is my true pure vision version. Mm-hmm. There's like 3 other versions on there. More game re-releases need to have that. And M2 does that to a degree.
Yeah.
Like, you know, their Sega Ages stuff, they've been pretty good about preserving like, well, here's the American version, here's the Japanese version, here's like a tweaked version of Sonic the Hedgehog where you have a spin dash. Like, that never existed, but it's cool. But no one else does it. No one else. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing to everyone that Nintendo released Sky Skipper. Just like, Sky Skipper exists. Wow. Like, Nintendo acknowledged it. Donkey Kong came out with all 3 international versions on it.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
And it
shouldn't be crazy. It should be, like, that should be the norm. That should be the accepted. We gotten way off topic here. What the hell happened?
We went into the preservation podcast.
Where did we go? BBS is.
Yeah, well, we were talking about console gaming and then Satellaview, and then I think we have to mention the Dreamcast. Well,
okay, but you guys are making a liar of me. I said this wouldn't be an hour long, and we're at 50 minutes now.
Or the Sega Netlink.
But this whole genre is stuff that's hard. Early online stuff is hard to preserve. It's hard to replicate.
I agree.
Because it was very much of the time, and you know, it's all old hardware.
Well, I mean, how do you preserve the experience of a BBS with the people who were using BBSs in 1985?
And the like mucks that I spent an entire summer on, you know, that was a whole world. It's gone. You know, there's no way to get that back. No one has a copy of that.
Where's Elucia?
Yeah.
It's gone.
Is it not in the Wayback Machine?
I don't know. Probably not. I think it predates the Wayback Machine.
It probably does predate the Wayback Machine.
I mean, this is like 1994, 95.
Yeah. Well, I have an answer for your question.
Do it.
Which is that I've spent a lot of time talking about this and talking to other people with similar ideas, like Henry Lowood of Stanford and J.P. Dyson of The Strong and Jason Scott and Frank Cifaldi and all these names. We're all buddies. We all hang out together.
Wow, name dropping.
Yep, we're all buddies. No, but I mean, we are actually all buddies.
All right, get to the point.
No, the point is that I was going to do an article about this years ago, and I was asking all these people the same thing, which is how do you preserve these experiences that are ephemeral?
Mm-hmm.
And I came to the conclusion that it's like, how do you preserve the world? How do you preserve your life? You know, you can't go back to see exactly how life was in the 30s. That's how complicated a World of Warcraft server is with all the culture and all the people on it at that time. The best thing you can do is take pictures and video caps, you know, screenshots. And so The Strong, not because of me, they started their own system of recording people playing these games and the experiences around them, which is a really neat idea. And I think maybe a Stanford is doing that too. But, you know, I think that that's going to be the solution on these complicated multiplayer things. Yeah. It's not just preserving Super Mario Brothers, which you can play over and over again, since they're becoming multiplayer experiences intrinsically. And they're being updated in real time. Like Fortnite keeps getting updates. Minecraft was like that. And
I mean, Fortnite already, like, it's only been around for about, you know, a year or so. Yeah. And already, like, the sky is broken and there's like weird stuff happening. And it's a different world than
it was.
It's
like a living world that keeps changing, you know.
It makes me think there's a lot of stuff potentially out there to be mined, because at a certain point, a lot of these experiences started keeping logs and things. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'm pretty sure, you know, in a subfolder of an old hard drive archive on my hard drive, I have the logs from like the Myth tournaments I ran, and that you could theoretically, with a working version of Myth, play back, including like this. I'm pretty sure people's comments are in there, and like the whole way game win is on there. And so these things are out there somewhere, and it's just
I love Twitch because you can see the playback of the chat while they're, if you watch a playback of the thing. Yeah. That's so cool.
But you know, on the other hand, you know, we were talking earlier about the Satellaview, and you know, talking about how Nintendo doesn't care about preserving that experience because it's, you know,
not
gone
financially, like, viable.
Yeah, who cares about that one broadcast? And you know, there is a I think, especially in Japanese culture, the philosophy that the idea that, you know, something is precious because it disappears,
the ephemeral
vanishes, and that's why you should you know, cherish it, because you can only have that experience once. You know, a river is only the same river once.
Yeah, there are people like, I know Jason Scott has written violently against that idea, like the idea of that forgetting is good and that deleting things is good. He wants to save everything. Although in my, and I generally, I agree that we should collect everything we can now to let historians of the future make sense of what happened. Although just personally, as I'm getting older and I'm sorting through trinkets and stuff I saved from when I was a kid, like just because I moved, I realized that it is some of the stuff I've lost that's the most special. It's not what, it's like my first car. I don't have that anymore. But if I still had it, it'd be just a damn old rusted car. It'd in the backyard.
Crap, yeah.
It wouldn't be that experience that I remembered, you know?
Yeah. Well, so I, you know, I wish.
From a personal standpoint, forgetting is good sometimes, or not forgetting, losing and you know, losing things.
Having it just as memories.
I'm kind of torn because yeah. As a historian, you know, someone who works in video game history, I want to make a record of this, all of this, and keep it alive and, you know, make it accessible and available to future generations. Like that's what I'm doing with the Game Boy books and mm-hmm. NES books that I mm-hmm. publish. But at the same time, like I do feel, you know, like the experiences are fleeting, you know, the things that I love that make Super Nintendo so precious to me, a lot of it has to do with who I was at the time and the impact of that technology in my life. Like at the time I looked at, you know, I played Super NES games and I was like blown away by the mm-hmm. sound and the graphics.
Yep.
And now I look at them and it's just, you know, like how many games have we played with that level of technology? You know, you no matter how many times I play ActRaiser, I'm never going to have the ActRaiser experience that mm-hmm. I did the first time. I'm never going to have another moment where I'm playing Final Fantasy IV and I hear the theme of the dungeons and I'm like, how is my game system doing that? I've got to turn this up and just like stand here and listen to it. What is mm-hmm. happening? I mean, no, yeah. Things have moved on and I've moved on. And that's okay.
To the new generations either, how powerful that was.
Right.
It's just not possible. I've tried, you know, for years to describe how Super Mario Brothers 1 was the greatest thing that ever happened. But now it's just so, oh yeah, it's just,
yeah. I mean, all I can do is, you know? Explain the context to it and let people understand, yeah, like, you know, once upon a time, we were little cave people and, you know, having 32 levels with hidden coins, that was crazy.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the secrets. But yeah, so that's just, there's a wave in every generation of people who come up in popular media who capitalize on nostalgia. Like the people who grew up in the 50s and the 80s and stuff, they started making movies about the 50s and stuff. And there's like Ready Player One is tailor-made for people our age who grew up in the 80s with all those experiences. I don't think it'll be as powerful in this. It won't be experienced the same way as someone who grew up in a different generation because it doesn't mean the right. same thing to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think Stranger Things is probably a better example of something that's like yeah. the 80s. Yeah.
This podcast is now about being old. Just
podcast is always about being true. Old. But we are getting old yeah. as we talk here. This was supposed to be like a half hour podcast. Well, it's now almost an hour.
We hit some early gaming stuff. I mean, I do.
I feel like a really good organic discussion, and I'd like to have more discussions like this on the show. So it's great. Hopefully everyone else listening agrees, but yeah, instead of, you know, putting a neat bow on things, let's kind of leave it open-ended so we can reconvene at some point.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about Dreamcast online gaming, yeah. which was the first time.
I mean, we got to talk about Sega Swirl. Come on.
Yeah. time they took it seriously.
Right. So we'll talk about that sometime.
Okay.
I feel like for now we've gone
beyond.
Way over the length, just like we always do with Retronauts Micro. Good God, what the hell is wrong with us? But yeah, thanks. I really enjoyed this episode because for the most part, I was like a passive observer and I don't get to have that experience very often. So thank you for letting me experience Retronauts the way the rest of the world does.
Yeah, it was fun.
People who don't research, you know, for several hours and then lead a podcast. It was great. But yeah, like hearing about all these experiences that I never got to enjoy and have only experienced, like I said, you know, like I said, second, third hand through things like Halt and Catch Fire. It's just always interesting to hear about. So thank you guys for sharing your experience. Do you want to tell us where we can find you talking about BBSs or whatever online?
Gosh, I don't know. I'm all over the place. Just Google modems or BBSs and my name will pop up. Probably. I'm actually not joking. I'm Ben Edwards. I run vintagecomputing.com. You can find me also on Twitter at Ben Edwards. And Ben?
I'm Ben Elgin. I'm on Twitter as Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N. I also have a retro gaming blog, which has been, or not retro gaming, but retro in general blog, which has been sadly neglected this year, but I'll get back to. It's at kirinsretrocloset.tumblr.com, only one N in that, Kirin. There's definitely some old Bungie game stuff up there at any rate. I don't know if there's any BBS stuff up there, but we'll see.
Anyway, thanks again, guys, for joining. Thanks, everyone up there, for listening. And we'll talk some more about this stuff, this freeform, rambling video game history, computer experience, whatever the hell this was. I enjoyed it. Hope you did, too. Retronauts, enjoy my Kirby timeline theory.
Making letters, handwritten letters in the mail. We're going to read them to you now.
Hi, everyone. Just kidding. I don't have a Kirby timeline theory, and you're not going to enjoy it, even if I did. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to have a little episode where we catch up with listener mail, because there's a bunch that's come in that I haven't necessarily been able to include in all my episodes. And for this exciting ride through your brains, I have dragged along.
Hi, it's Bob Mackey. I'm known best for my beta hyped up arrogance. I don't know what that means, but someone sent me that comment.
Have you ever had a beta fish? They are like so arrogant and hyped up.
I think they're saying I'm a beta male.
They kill each other.
I've never seen a hyped beta fish.
Did you put two beta fish together?
Oh, yeah.
Two male beta fish together? They're called fighting fish for a reason.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I think they mean
Actually, it's like brutal
horrific.
And horrible.
Yeah, probably.
I think they're saying I'm a beta male.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not a soy boy. I drink
beta
almond milk.
Beta is obsolete. VHS is obsolete. I am a Blu-ray male.
I'm a DivX male.
Oh, no. You self-destruct.
No.
That's obvious.
Sorry. Who's this other person in here?
Hi. I'm Shivam, and I'm actually just a mail order.
A mail order?
Yeah. A mail ordered male.
Gamer.
A mail ordered male.
Orderly? So anyway, thank you, everyone, for all the letters that you submit for our solicitations for listener mail. You are listeners, not readers. I'm sorry that I don't always manage to squeeze these into episode recording sessions, but sometimes the conversation's just so good and so voluminous that we don't have time. But that doesn't mean we've forgotten about you. So there are quite a few games that we're going to run through in the next half hour or so. Suikoden 1 and 2, Final Fantasy 6, Mega Man X, those last two from months back. And thank you for those of you who resubmitted your comments. There's a couple of other things. Let's see. I don't know. We'll figure it out when we get there. But let's just jump straight in. So with Suikoden 1 and 2, Saving Princess says, "The love I have for Suikoden 1 and 2 is only matched by the disappointment I had in Suikoden 3. All the sprite-based charm, the character design, the music, everything seemed to be completely lost in the rest of the series. 1 and 2 felt more like two halves of a whole in the same way A New Hope and The Force Awakens do." Okay, that's not the comparison I would make there.
The New Hope and Force Awakens is more like a copy of...
Yeah, like The Force Awakens and Last Jedi, those feel like two parts of a whole.
Yeah.
I don't know so much about... Okay.
But sure. At least we understand where you're coming from, though. At least the spirit is there.
It's a well-intended place of the heart.
However, I mean, is there more to that or...
Just go
for
it.
I mean, however, I do kind of disagree with the premise because Suikoden 1 and 2 are... phenomenal, obviously. But Suikoden 3 gets a short shrift from a lot of people because the...
Because it's poop?
Because the look changed so dramatically. But the soundtrack was phenomenal. The Grasslands theme is amazing.
It's a good soundtrack.
There's a lot of really good songs. The thing about
a janky game with a great soundtrack is that you can get a different disc that has just the soundtrack and enjoy that without the jank.
But here's the thing, though. The thing about Tekken 3 that really resonated, that makes it really good even when you go back to it now, is that like the way that the stories were told with the three different viewpoints kind of going over the same thing to give you a different taste of like the colonial view versus the indigenous view.
Yes, Rashomon, gotta catch them all.
It really is actually cool. And Hugo being one of the first brown characters I've seen in a JRPG.
That's true.
Fair enough.
I mean, it was for me as an Indian dude, it resonated a lot. I mean, I'm never going to say that it's as good as 1 and 2, but it's definitely – it's like Chrono Cross. It's better than you think it is. But the name hurts it a lot.
Amazing. Yeah.
Well, is it really you are like unique in that.
Oh, okay. I would play it. I mean, I'm never going to play it again, 3. But if you're going to play it, I would use an emulator with a frame skip button, because what I remember most about the game is just like there are so many loading screens.
The game was slow.
It's of its time.
Yep. That's my big problem. Cloudy Music says, I love the idea of being able to import your save file from the first game into the second one and have it actually impact certain things throughout the game. Like a lot of things in the North American release of Suikoden 2, it was a little buggy. Yeah, we talked about that in the episode. That's Suikoden episode. You can hear more about that. Peter Rusevitz says, Suikoden 1 showed me that turn-based fights can be dynamic in execution. I loved it. Great games, much better than the 3D sequels. 2D artwork does not have problems with textures and low-poly models.
Yeah.
Nathaniel Everett Crocker says, the Suikoden games do something wonderful that not a lot of other game series do successfully, and that's tell epic scale stories that are nevertheless contained within a small portion of a much larger world that is only gestured at. Contrast this with, say, Final Fantasy, which almost always has a world map that is completely traversable by the climax of the game.
I actually agree with that. That's one of my favorite parts about the Suikoden series. Like when I was in college, I had the maps of the games on my wall and kind of linked up in a way to show how the globe might look. And the fact that Suikoden, in like those games, you meet characters who imply that they're from a different section of the world. And in like the sequel, you go to that section of the world. And in later games, you go to another section. And it feels like, oh, we're doing these huge epic scale battles, but they're actually just a tiny corner of this continually growing world. And that was, I think, one of the real peaks of that series.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the Evilist games where you're not seeing the entire world. You're only seeing part of it at a time.
Exactly.
Rajan says this about Suikoden 2's Joey. A lot of people don't like the character or buy into his character development, but I think the game does a wonderful job justifying them. Just by talking to NPCs, you get a feel for the long-held animosity between the game's two factions, an animosity that won't just end because a peace is made. So I had real sympathy for the decision Joey made to continue the conflict after Luca Blight's death. Speaking of Luca, I was amazed how perfectly Joey serves as a foil for both the cartoonishly evil Luca Blight and the remarkably virtuous protagonist. The first half of the game is incredibly cut and dry morally, lulling a player into a false sense of security before cold, hard reality sets in with Joey's heel turn.
Could not agree more.
Rowan Idris Carmichael says, Suikoden is a series I want to love, but every time I play through the original, I just feel so unenthused. I hope listening to you guys will give me a greater appreciation for the series.
Shivam,
that's your clarion call.
Oh my God. Suikoden 1 is one of just like, it is one of the, my comfort food game. It is like, and so I wish I knew what it was that didn't drag you, because the thing is, when you're playing this game, you start out as just this young man who is this hero who's lost in this world. Your father is like working for the evil empire, but then you're just building up and exploring this world, discovering these new things, talking to these people. You're discovering the length and depth of this conflict. How does it not drag you in? How do you not care about these people by the end of it?
I can kind of see this. I feel like the beginning hours of the game, the first 5 or 6 hours, they're kind of visually repetitive. So you're waiting. Once you get to the castle and can start adding people to it, I think it really does hook you by then.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm just trained by RPGs by that point to just expect like, oh, it's going to be kind of generic featureless. But man, that story hooks you.
All right, Jeremy, not me, says, as much as I love Suikoden, I was beyond excited for the release of Suikoden 2, which improved upon the original in nearly every way possible and to this day remains my favorite game of all time.
Amen.
Not sure I have the words adequately to describe my love for the sequel, but I'm sure by now others have done a fine job as its reputation is well earned.
I mean, yeah, Suikoden 2, best game of all time. I will stand on that.
Scott Scussi says, I love the Suikoden series, especially the second game. The first game is a delight, but a little insubstantial. I would compare those two games to Mega Man 1 and 2 and how the first game was good, but the sequel managed to improve on it in just about every way. I would rank it up there in the best of its genre. In an astounding stroke of luck, I got the game in 2002 or so after stumbling on it in a thrift store and paid about $5 for it. That might be the best money I've ever spent.
Man, by then the game would have been like – it was costing over $100 on eBay back then.
Yeah, by 2000 it was already
– I mean it was rare. It was hard like to get.
$120, yeah. Dr. Agan says, I am from South Africa and back in the 90s we had literally no access to any games that weren't sports games. I made an email for pen pal from Thailand, and the guy sent me about 40 games I'd never heard of, most of them Japanese.
Nice.
But the three that stood out for me were Wild Arms, Vandal Hearts, and Suikoden, all of which I had never heard of. I had somehow, through vague relatives, possessed an Intellivision, a Master System, and a Famicom by that time, but had never delved into to experience the JRPG genre. Suikoden was my first and still one of the best. I still get goosebumps when I hear the Island Fortress theme song. It was one of the first times that I dealt with permanent virtual death as part of a narrative. I will love everything about Suikoden until the day I die.
You know, people always say like, oh man, losing that girl in Final Fantasy VII totally made me cry. I'm like, nah, dude, Gremio, that'll make you cry.
I don't know. Like I said, Gremio is a little – like his death is a little goofy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going blind because of the spores.
And I mean, when you're walking through that door and you see this weird looking room that doesn't look like any other room in the building, you're like,
yeah, it's like in Mass Effect 2 when you walk into a room and it's a big open box and there's a lot of like crates on the ground. You're like, what's going to be a shootout here?
I'm going to guess something is going to happen.
Ted Buffa says, just over a year ago, I had major surgery on my ankle. Knowing that I was going to be laid up for the better part of 3 months, I decided to catch up on some classic RPGs that I'd missed. Among these were the first two Suikoden games. Recovery was considerably more intense than I could have expected and I had to keep my leg in its cast elevated at all times. I spent the first couple of weeks lying on the ground, foot in the air. I kept a spreadsheet of all 108 stars of Destiny and worked my way through both games. I discovered a treasure of wonderful mashed-together ideas and a healthy dose of town building. These two games were the perfect distraction from an otherwise rough patch in my life. Kevin Bunch says, after a friend lent me his copy in high school circa 1998, Suikoden became the first RPG I became really obsessed with after playing Earthbound years prior. I love the story of intrigue, the battle system, the way your castle grew, and the secret little tricks needed to finish the game with all 108 stars.
Yep. It's like if you step on these three plants in this one city, you won't get the guy
because
he's a gardener and he's mad that you crushed his plants.
Wait, is that really a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah,
in Suikoden 1 at the very end.
I knew from the beginning I wanted all the stars, so I used the fact to make sure I didn't like destroy my chances.
Nice.
That's the only reason I used the fact.
I didn't realize that. Wow.
Oh, yeah. No, there were a lot of those. There were a lot of just like, oh, I triggered something really dumb and now I can't get this guy. But it's so cool. I just love it.
Brian Reynolds says, right now the prevailing opinion seems to be that the original Suikoden is okay, but really just something to blow through as quickly as possible in order to get to the real masterpiece. I wouldn't say that the original is better than the sequel or anything like that. But I do think the original Suikoden is a great game in its own right. One moment near the end of the original Suikoden always stuck out to me. After kicking the Scarlet Moon Empire's butt across the land and claiming all its top generals for your own, you finally make it back to the capital of Gregminster, your hometown, for the final battle. And the capital, which started out as a vibrant city full of peaceful memories for your main character, is now completely empty, abandoned by all its people, and even the color palette has been toned down from green and gold to brown and gray.
Yeah.
Even in the music is even more affecting is the music, where the same bright and happy town theme music you hear in the beginning of the game is still present but softer, slower, and always threatened to be drowned out by the whooshing wind blowing through the deserted city.
Yeah, that always totally resonated with me.
It's the first game I can remember that made me feel like I was the hero and made all the right choices, but even if those choices were still right, they had negative consequences as well.
Yeah, I mean that going back to Gregminster at the end, which is cut off from the beginning of the game, after you leave that place with like all the generals, when you finally make it back to your home, you're like, oh my god, what has this war done to this place? And it's really just an affecting moment.
From Luke Underwood, he actually has a point that he bolded and underlined in his letter.
Ooh.
That underscores something that I said in the Suikoden episode. The attack animations, coupled with the extra crunchy sound effects when bashing or slicing an enemy, gave the turn-based combat a much more kinetic feel than any JRPG I had played up to that point. That is absolutely correct.
Yes, sir.
Was that 2009's Jeremy Parrish who said that?
Yes, that was me from the past. What? Lou Grand says, no matter how many times I played Suikoden 1 or 2, I played with the same team. Flick, Victor, Alan, Grinsil, Hero, and a dealer's choice character. wonder what that means.
Dealer's choice means just whatever he's the story forces on.
I see. I intentionally cripple myself because Flick, Victor, and the Knight characters are all short range, which means one of them is in the back row and useless unless they're good with magic. I did this because I always beat the game with the fancy lat attack, and I couldn't bear bear to separate Flick and Victor. And anyway, that's when I realized I was gay.
what a way to end a comment.
Come on. That was great.
Like I said, I discovered yaoi because of Sukuden when looking up fan art for this game.
So let's jump into the Mega Man X mailbag, which happened a long time ago.
It's like who was president at this time?
We don't have a president anymore. From Luis Guillermo Jimenez Gomez. I've always loved Mega Man X since playing it on Super NES, but I don't think it really hit me how sophisticated and minutely designed it is until years later when finishing it on GameCube, especially after playing Mega Man 2 and 3 and becoming aware of how X builds on the strengths of its predecessors while introducing new elements that series would take in different directions in the future. Hmm. David Dalrymple says, Mega Man X is one of my ultimate comfort food games, which I can play for an hour or two of stress-free action delight. Its boss patterns are easy to reliably follow. The controls are tight and responsive, and the game is forgiving in a way that Mega Man games typically aren't.
Yeah, I think it wasn't until my early 20s maybe at the earliest that I realized just how sophisticated and great Mega Man X is. I just thought of it before, like, oh, it's a better looking Mega Man. But as I said on that episode, I think it is the best Mega Man game.
I agree.
The thing that always got me about X was the fact that when I first saw him running uphill, it blew my mind. I was just like, Mega Man can run uphill?
There are diagonals. Oh,
Jamie Williams says, Mega Man X was the perfect evolution of the NES Mega Man series. The general gameplay formula was familiar, but the art and mechanics were new enough to set it apart from the classic universe and justify another series. Finding all the upgrades, heart tanks, and the Hadouken occupied many hours of my time. For some reason, I got the idea to hold my breath during the underwater portions of Launch Octopus's stage. It's
doable. I do not encourage this.
Yeah, it seems like a really good way to hurt yourself. Alfonso Jose Rivera Rojas says, Mega Man X was the game that made me fall in love with the Mega Man X series and the whole Mega Man franchise. Hmm. While I had read previews of the game in a local video game magazine, it wasn't until I played the game that I realized how amazing it is. I still remember going to a friend's house when I was 10 years old, about a year after the game was released, and seeing my friend blazing through the game. I was instantly hooked with its tight mechanics, clever level design, and superb and badass character designs. Rijon Lagasse says, Mega Man X is probably my favorite video game of all time. I could wax at length on how amazing the level design and art is, but to keep this brief, I'll just mention something that you seem to have omitted in the podcast. It impressed me how bosses would sometimes have a secondary weakness to exploit. While Launch Octopus may take more damage from the rolling shield subweapon, if you hit him with the boomerang cutters, his arms fall off, rendering him nearly defenseless. Huh. It's a minor thing, but as a veteran from the NES Mega Man games, this blew my mind, opening a whole world of opportunities that the devs actually did very little with in the long run.
But it is a good way to get replay value out of the game.
I agree.
I feel like all those little touches we talked about are not in the sequels. They're missing, like how certain stages will change and those little touches.
I feel like Mega Man X, they really just went out of their way to do all these amazing things. And then in the later ones, they're like, you know, let's just stick to the ones we need and not the ones that nobody's ever going to see.
Yeah.
Ryan Fuhrheim says, Mega Man is my favorite game series of all time, and Super NES X games are included. I have a tattoo of X doing the classic Mega Man power slide. Wait a minute. He doesn't do that. He dashes.
Oh, what? Oh God. We shouldn't tell this person this.
As the focal point of my video game sleeve, and my fiance and I took Mega Man themed save the date photos for our upcoming wedding. I was ecstatic to get a Super NES Classic, and Mega Man X was the first game I played. After listening to the brilliant Retronauts episode over X, oh shucks, I went back and challenged myself by doing a Buster-only run. I was successful, but less so when I tried beating the game without any power-ups.
Hmm. I gotta say, I'm not a fan of all these people who are like Buster-only purists. Like, the game gives you sub-weapons. They're cool. Use them and don't feel bad about using them.
Yeah, Buster-only is good for Mega Man 4.
I have a tattoo of Mario holding his famous sword, so don't feel bad.
Da-na-na-na.
The Excalibur?
Yeah, sure.
Jose Daniel says, Mega Man X is, to me, the greatest game ever made. There's a lot of people saying this.
Mm, they're copying it.
People haven't played Sega then, obviously.
It wasn't my first Mega Man. Okay, Shivam. Are you peasing out now? Is that it? We talked about Suikoden and you're done.
Don't drop our mics on the floor.
They're expensive.
They're very expensive.
I'm just getting very miffed by all these people who just don't understand the true greatest games of all time. I'm just saying.
They will on their deathbed. It was Suikoden.
Oh, so here's my favorite part of Jose's letter. I remember fighting for dear life against Vile, having no idea the fight was scripted. I wondered why the dash button did nothing, only to then find the Dr. Light capsule that gave me the game-changing dash ability. It's a learning experience. And finally, whoa, my goodness.
Somebody said their senior thesis, man.
Paul van der Weijen says everything. Wow, that's our entire podcast transcript right there.
Thank you for typing all that up.
Boy, let me trim this down.
So Mega Man X is just such a cool game. And like putting the Hadouken in there was such a cool idea. And I just wish I was better at Mega Man games.
Yeah, okay. So here's a highlight. When I finally got my hands on the game, my 13-year-old mind was blown away. From the highway level with its battle-damaged car fleeing the scene and giant B-copters, X's ability to dash to the screen-filling terror that is Sigma's Final Four, X1 was so far beyond what I could have imagined, it left a lasting impression. Up to this day, I play the game at least once a year from start to finish, hooking up my old Super NES to the TV. Even now, I'm still struck by how right this game feels and just how much attention was given to detail. Like how the armored armadillo boss loses a shell after being hit by the electric spark, or the way levels are affected after beating certain bosses. Not to mention the music. It truly feels like a labor of love.
Was this on the SNES Classic?
It is, yeah.
Okay, I should go home and play it.
Okay, so let's move on to Final Fantasy VI, which we also talked about a billion years ago. actually, Shivam, you weren't on that episode.
No, I was on the Final Fantasy V episode.
Do you have thoughts about Final Fantasy VI?
It's a good game.
Well done. Okay, great. I think everyone agrees. So this is from Josh Garvey. It's also very lengthy. Okay, let's go with the final dungeon was a joy. That fight with Kefka was a sight to behold. I'm curious what everyone's strategy for the final dungeon was. My first time through, I used Mog with the Moogle Charm to turn off random encounters for one group, which kind of bit me in the butt when underleveled Mog, Umaro, Gogo, and Gao tried to take on one of the statues. I think this also started my longstanding enjoyment of breaking games wide open, which Final Fantasy VI is kind of notorious for. The offering in Genji Glove, the gem box and economizer, making fun use of the merit badge. It was a fun sandbox to experiment in. What does the merit badge do?
I can look it up actually. But I will say that I didn't use the Moogle Charm on any place but the Tower of Mages or whatever, just because it was such a pain in the ass. And it was an easy way to cheat. I think that was just installed in the game in case you wanted to get past that one area and get Strago.
Yep.
Maybe Strago, I don't know. I use that to get to that's where you get the gem box or whatever?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
I also kind of love the Ted Woolseyisms. Slit his mama's throat for a nickel. Son of a submariner. Do I look like a waiter? The limitations are clear, but there was so much charm.
So the merit badge allows the wearer to equip almost any piece of equipment. Mm. So that's a very, very good relic.
So another long one from Scott Schneider. Final Fantasy VI was the first game I played where I felt I had the freedom to do things. Part of this is because I'm mostly a console gamer. I believe PC RPGs at the time had way more freedom. But the World of Ruin in Final Fantasy VI, yeah. We've I don't know when this episode is going up, but we just recorded some conversations on Ultima and Bard's Tale and got very much into how long it took for console RPGs to catch up to the openness of PC RPGs. The World of Ruin in Final Fantasy VI was the first time I'd experienced I can go do what I want in a game. It's almost but not quite a 16-bit version of open world. I distinctly remember loading up my saved game in World of Ruin at a friend's house and feeling a sense of place unlike most other games. I could load up my save, explore, and accomplish things without an explicit goal in mind. Then I quickly realized, wow, Final Fantasy VI is one of my favorite games ever. Aaron Middleton says, I noticed you guys didn't say much about the relic system. It's completely understandable given how much there is to say about Final Fantasy VI, but I thought it was worth revisiting. The versatility of the relic system is perfect for the game's more loose and open-ended design. So relics are basically accessories you can equip to per character, such as the merit badge.
That's right.
The tightness of Final Fantasy V's design is appealing in a different way, but the restrictions of the job system mean that experimentation sometimes requires long hours of grinding. With Final Fantasy VI, changing a character's abilities is as simple as giving them a different set of relics. And if that sounds a bit like Final Fantasy VII's materia system, that's because it is. Mm. In that sense, the game is what you make of it.
Yeah, the relics or the accessories or whatever you call them in future games would be dialed back a lot, and they were made less the uses were less powerful, or the changes were less powerful to your character.
Yeah, sure. And I think it also is like a game balance issue, because the fact that you could just make your characters just nigh invulnerable with like the right loadout.
Yeah, with the Genji glove and the offering? Is that the double and then two Atma weapons?
Yep.
And you're just fucking owning everything.
Yeah. Of course, then you have Final Fantasy XIII, where all you could equip was two accessories.
Yeah, that's right.
You didn't
right.
have armor.
Yeah, but Final Fantasy XIII, you didn't actually play, so it doesn't matter.
That's bullshit.
You eventually play in hour 40. It's a bad game. Let's move on. That's my beta hyped up arrogance again.
Yeah, that is. It really is.
13.3 is great.
John Hyman says, let's see. I love that for all the talk about love in the first half of Final Fantasy VI, Terra doesn't end up with a partner, instead becoming a Mother Teresa-like figure to the orphans. It's Locke and Celis who get the romantic arc, but they need to get over themselves and their hang-ups before it can begin. I think there are lessons there for all of us.
Yeah, as Dr. Phil would say, you gotta love yourself.
Daniel Greenberg says, back in May 2017, I received my MA in computer game design, capped off with a thesis entitled Brava, Celis, Shared Narrative Elements in Video Games and Opera as a Framework for Game Appreciation. Rooted in years of research on transmediation, literacy, critique, and the nascent field of game appreciation, the real seed for that paper was planted in 1994. I didn't really know or understand opera beyond Bugs Bunny until recent years, when I began studying them closely. While attending one from the cheap seats at the Kennedy Center, an elderly gentleman and World War II vet that stayed in Italy after his service talked about his time there and how the kids in the nearby alleyways could hear the performances coming from the opera house and would sing them outside, filling the area with music. Trying to remember what moved me at that age with such fervor, Final Fantasy VI immediately sprang to mind. Emboldened, I rushed home and pulled an all-nighter, pouring over opera's dynamic history and creative toolkits, all the while realizing I'd finally found my thesis. As my appreciation for the form grew, I started seeing all manner of similarities to what had been carefully woven into Final Fantasy VI. The overlaps were uncanny. The basso buffo of Locke and Ultros, Maria Callas's Tosca to Celis Scherer's Maria, the Figaro twins, the symbolism of Setzer Gabbiani's Gulls, the brilliant leveraging of stage, music, drama, and leitmotif. I could go on. In 1976, Will Crowther's Adventure came out, the same year one of classical opera's last celebrated composers, Benjamin Britten, passed. I'm not saying a metaphorical torch was passed necessarily, but I am optimistic that video games are technically equipped and more than capable of tackling and preserving opera's multimedia majesty, and no title I know of stands as better proof than Final Fantasy VI. I will link to his thesis in the show notes.
Yeah, you know, that's good.
That was way too intellectual for me. I feel stupid.
And
now,
if you haven't listened to Maria Callas's Tosca, it is phenomenal. Even if you're not an opera fan, like my in-laws made me listen to it once on record, and I was just like, holy crap, this is...
From Ben Elgin, Retronauts East regular, Final Fantasy VI has always been a linchpin game for me. Final Fantasy I introduced me to console RPGs, and IV expanded that with real characters and expansive, if a bit cliche, story. But VI is really the one that made me an addict for years to come and convinced me to follow Squaresoft to whatever new console they were developing for. As the culmination of the series' 2D lifespan, 6 really pulls out all the stops with gorgeous, detailed sprite work, an amazing leitmotif-based score from Uematsu, and an explosion of characters with all their own interesting backstories and story vignettes. To this day, it remains near the top of almost any list of favorite games I may make based on any criteria.
I really want to replay it on the SNES Classic. The last time I replayed it was in 2007 when the Game Boy Advance one came out. So it's been a long time, and I have played this game like 4 or 5 times.
It's like 12 years.
The only time I've ever played the game was on the GBA version because I was a Genesis kid, not a Super Nintendo kid. So it's funny because like everybody uses this as one of their like linchpin titles that changed their life or whatever. For me, that was like this time I was playing Phantasy Star 4, which colored a lot of how I look at RPGs. So it's always been just kind of weird to be like, oh, I guess I just speak a different language than everybody else does. Because when I went back and played Final Fantasy VI, I was like, the opera is just a bunch of squawking. I don't get it. This is weird.
Yeah, I wonder how I would feel if I went on the Sega path instead.
I mean, it just doesn't have the same resonance as the first time you play it when you're 13.
It's weird. It doesn't sound like a farting robot. I don't get it.
Oh, no.
Just
you
kidding.
You unlocked a world of hurt.
Oh, no.
No, I think I had played it. It was so hyped up by the time I got to it that I was just like forced in the other direction.
It's true. I bought it when it was new, so there were no expectations. I mean, the reviews were really good, and I love Final Fantasy, but it didn't have all the baggage it has today of being this life-changing experience.
From Jeff Peterson, Final Fantasy VI is one of the games I cite as the reason my girlfriend and I became closer and eventually got married.
Aww.
She would rent the game from a locally owned rental shop in Sacramento, and we played it together. We loved the story and drama, the characters' experience in the first half of the game, cried at the destruction of the world and Celis's remorse at the loss of Cid as she threw herself off the cliff. We got frustrated at the sudden freedom of the world of ruin, but enjoyed finding new areas to explore and getting all the party back together again. We struggled and eventually persevered against our most favorite villain of all time, despite Kefka's repeated attempts with Heartless Angel and Forsaken. After we graduated from high school and she went to college while I went into the military, I found a Funko Land selling a used copy of Final Fantasy VI in the box with the game manual. I didn't hesitate. I bought the game and a Super NES and sent it to my wife as a present. We still pull the game out and play it every so often, and now our kids are playing it too. The music, graphic, story, and gameplay have truly stood the test of time.
That's sweet.
It's very heartwarming.
That was a very good letter. Let's see. Jay Thompson says, on the first day of second grade, an older kid who just moved into my neighborhood joined me on the bus ride home. While becoming fast friends over a mutual love of video games, he started regaling me with stories of this game he had been following in game magazines. It was all the rage in Japan and was on its way out in the U.S. soon. After gushing about how awesome it looked, he said, it'll even be better than Zelda. I laughed it off at the time as hardly anything I had played at that point quite matched up to the majesty of A Link to the Past. But I can't deny the game looked utterly entrancing when he finally got his hands on it. That game, of course, was Final Fantasy VI. The game was a bit too much for me when I first asked to try it out, but I eventually figured it out and became a quick fan of the franchise. The game certainly has its flaws, and I think I was right to give a childish nuh-uh to my friend's claim that it was surpassed Zelda, but it's still a wonderful game. Let's see.
Yeah, man. If you had told me when I was a kid that Final Fantasy VI was better than Link to the Past, I would have scoffed entirely.
I'm glad we didn't have to have that schoolyard fight. Jonathan A. Weinhold says, a lot gets made of the music of Final Fantasy VI, but people rarely mention the sheer magnitude of what was composed. Mm-hmm. In a time where nearly all video game work was little more than a 1 to 2 minute loop, Uematsu wrote not just the opera scene that's like 8 to 9 minutes long, not just the music for the multi-tiered Kefka fight, but then also like 20 minutes of credits music. The soundtrack absolutely drips of effort and care and ambition, and Uematsu should be thanked for it.
Yeah, I think his soundtracks for 7, 8, and 9 were bigger, but I think 6 has the – I don't think there's a bad song in 6, frankly.
I think 6 is actually just – the soundtrack of 6 to me is better than all the ones that were made on the PS1.
Oh, I totally agree.
And it's just like, wow, that – I mean, that might be his peak probably.
I think so, creatively.
Okay, and finally, Blarg says – I replayed Final Fantasy VI via Wii Virtual Console earlier this year. Uh-huh. For the most part, my memories hold up about the game. The music is excellent, the battle system is varied, and the graphics look good even on my HDTV. Even with the warbled lyrics, the opera is one of the most outrageous, engaging, and fun scenarios I've ever seen in any JRPG. I still gasp a little when Kefka kills Emperor Gestal and then pushes his body off the floating island. By the end of the game, my party is overpowered and Kefka's final form went down in 2 turns. It makes me wish it had the endgame bosses of later Final Fantasies. I know there is a GBA version, but I can't make it past an hour with that bastardized music. Ooh. So, you know, there is a patch that you can download And this entails playing the game somewhat illegally.
Oh, God, no.
But there is a patch that fixes the music. So if you own the GBA version, do not have any compunctions about getting hold of the GBA ROM and patching the music to sound the way God intended.
At that point,
stick it on an EverDrive. It's great.
At that point, just play the Super Nintendo ROM if you're going to go that far.
Well, I think, you know, if you want to experience the additional content the revised localization, like, you know, what happens when it's Blizzara instead of Ice 2?
I'll lose my mind. But he brings up a good point. I mean, the opera scene is very we talk about it endlessly on here, but I feel like even that guy likes it.
I think so.
But it's hard to overstate just how important that was at the time it came out. And when I played it, I thought it was emotional, but that wasn't the thing that I took away from it the most. I was like, this is so cool. Like, I've never seen this in a game before. And I think 20 plus years of people praising that has made it I don't know. It has a different effect on people now.
Yeah.
Musically, it doesn't do anything for me, but as a set piece, it's a cool set piece in the
game. I like how you have to keep breaking different perspectives, going to different perspectives. Yeah. Like, you're above it, then you're below, and then, yeah, it's great.
So we're going to wrap this episode by talking about the Atari 7800. That episode has already gone up, and this mailbag didn't quite make it in, but it's not too late. Bastian Nocera says, I'm the guy who lives in 1983. My story with the 7800 will likely be disappointing to Atari fans, but I thought it would provide a good example of many a near Atari owner. In 1989, I knew I wanted a game console, and I also knew my parents weren't that well off. The three cheapest consoles were the 2600, about $70 at the time in French francs, the 7800, which is about $90, and the Sega Master System, about $120. Friends of the family had a 2600, and I could borrow cartridges if we bought any of the Atari systems. I pored over the catalogs during much of December, but just before heading off to the supermarket, my dad looked at the Atari graphics, said they weren't much better than the Thompson 8-bit Micro we already had, and decided on the Master System.
What the hell is that?
It's French.
Okay.
I thank him every time the Wonder Boy 3, Alex Kidd, or Golden Axe Warriors ditties pop into my head. In hindsight, the 7800 wasn't that much more powerful than the 2600 and the economics just didn't add up compared to the Master System. From nearly an Atari owner.
Hmm. Dodged a bullet there, man.
Really, yeah.
I don't know. 7800 is an okay system. It's about on par in terms of the this Master System.
Yeah, but the Master System had Phantasy Star.
Here we go.
Okay.
That is true. Actually, I agree with you on that. And ALF.
Yeah. I mean, it was better than the 7800, man. That's like, I think that's just objective.
Poor 7800. All right. From Steve Langerhulk. I was one of the few and proud to have an Atari 7800. My parents bought my brother and I a 2600 years earlier. We were hooked. By the time the 7800 came out, I already had friends who had the NES, but my 9-year-old brain probably doubted the future of this newcomer on the scene and wanted to stick with Atari. I don't remember what occasion it was that my parents got the system for me, but I was pretty happy with it despite never really mastering that controller with its weird button placement. Looking at the list of cartridges I had for the system, I realized everything I had was a port from some other system. But Ball Blazer looked amazing, and Joust looked so much better than the 2600 version. And I somehow found Robotron 2084 enjoyable just using one controller despite trying the dual controller setup once or twice. I was thrilled I could finally play a version of Choplifter at home, and Karateka was the only game I owned that had an ending, so far as I know. But I never did learn to deal with that damn bird.
Man.
A year or two later, my brother and I probably realized Atari wasn't the future based on the NES games we saw at our friend's house. We pulled together our allowance and money and bought an NES and Rygar.
Oh, good ending.
Rygar's great.
Going to make some friends with this one.
Really? I mean, who are the Atari 7800 diehards out there?
There's a few.
I will fight you in the street.
No, and I'm like, you know what, man? God bless. Enjoy yourself with that thing.
Yeah. It's fun to like things.
Knock yourself out.
Dr. Ias says, the 7800 was our family's first system bought way late, well into 1989, by a visiting uncle. And I'm pretty sure that Pole Position 2 was the first home game console or first home console video game I ever played. I don't remember buying any of its exclusives at all, but we did have a cousin who gave us a giant cardboard box filled with the various Atari cards he didn't want. So there were definitely a lot of games we must have played. You'd think I'd have a lot of nostalgia for the thing, but no, I can't remember even as an 8-year-old thinking that these games were mostly just time wasters. And it wasn't until I bought a Super Nintendo for myself years later that I felt like video games were something I really wanted to sink my time into. That said, Ms. Pac-Man, Q-Bert, and Keystone Capers are games I regularly return to and enjoy. Things like Spider-Man and Jungle Hunt with its fairly racist natives were things I distinctly remember mocking with friends at the time, like Good Little Progressives.
Pole Position and Q-Bert are really good, though. I really, really enjoyed playing Q-Bert, especially on the NES.
Is the Ms. Pac-Man for 7800 notoriously good or something?
It is good,
or,
yes. Okay. As opposed,
I've never played that
version.
Actually,
Ms. Pac-Man is not bad on Atari 2600, but the 7800 version is good. Aaron Breitweiser says, I only had a 2600 as a kid but acquired a 7800 a few years ago and instantly fell in love with the system. It presents an interesting sort of alt history of gaming. I imagine a world where the 7800 got its 1984 release, ideally with a built-in pokey sound chip, and wonder what the world would have been like if Atari consoles had continued being relevant.
You know, my uncle used to work at the Atari factory in Sunnyvale building the original consoles.
Oh, wow.
So
oh, yeah?
He built the he worked on the factory floor when he moved here to the States from India, and he had built 2600 and 5200s. I think by the time 7800 had come out, he had already left working at Atari. But I remember we used to get like carts and stuff from the factory floor.
Did he also apply like the fake wood panel sticker to the consoles?
I think he was doing like the soldering of the board.
He actually lumbered the trees. We'll wrap this up pretty quick. Matthew Wachter says, the 7800 was like a strange acquaintance growing up. A friend of mine always seemed to have the newest and best things. I have fond memories of my 8-year-old mind being blown on a regular basis by the coolest and most technologically advanced games of the day on his Apple II. The one thing that never quite seemed to fit the mold of his pampered lifestyle was that he willfully asked his parents for a 7800 instead of NES. I remember reluctantly going down to his basement to play Pole Position, an impossible mission on a huge rear projection TV.
Oh, my God. Pearls
before swine. I tried to tell him. I used to bring him copies of Nintendo Power and tried to get him to come over to play NES at my house whenever possible, but he just wouldn't listen. What was wrong with him? Was he abused as a child? Did his parents brainwash him with anti-Japanese sentiment? I think this may have irreparably damaged our friendship.
Or did he actually just have an NES in the hidden in the background that he just didn't show you, so he would force you to play the 7800?
Actually, I was incorrect. I said pearls before swine. It's the reverse of that. Like, is there an aphorism for that?
Like, swine before pearls?
Maybe. It's like
making a silk pouch out of a purse.
A sow's ear?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Write in your favorite aphorism to Retronauts.
Hey, kids.
We'll read it on the air.
One last letter. Kevin Richardson. I grew up an Atari kid, as at the time, I didn't know video games by any other name. We had Atari's 5200, so when the time came, the 7800 was the natural progression. Eventually, I got caught up in Nintendo fever after playing Contra and Life Force at a friend's house. When I started proposing Nintendo NES as a possible future birthday or Christmas gift, I heard these dreaded words, "You already have a video game system."
Oh.
I finally saved up enough money for myself for a Nintendo Entertainment System around the time Super NES came out, but I wouldn't trade my time with the 7800 for anything. It instilled in me a love for the classic arcade games, despite not having any actual arcades around where I grew up. The 7800 had great versions of everything from Zevius and Ms. Pac-Man and Galaga to the original Mario Brothers. And with backwards compatibility, could play the 2600s of Berserk, Warlords, and Space Invaders. So that
I could see that being appealing if you have to grow up around no arcades in that era. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know,
life is hard sometimes.
Yeah.
No, I feel like it's good to have a love of arcades instilled in you, however it happens. Mm-hmm. And the 7800 was a good console, as we talked about in our episode. It just,
there's nothing wrong with it. It came out at the wrong time.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it came out 3 years too late is the problem.
That is the very wrong time.
It should have come out much sooner, but it didn't. And that's the entire discussion that we had with the Atari 7800 episode of Retronauts. Look it up. It's on the internet.
Now consoles come out before the company is ready, like the Switch. And I love the Switch, but it's just like, where's your online? Line, buddy.
Cloud saves. Yeah. A mini interface. What?
It'll come in 2020. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very exciting. So that wraps it up for this Retronauts Micro. Thanks everyone who wrote in. Tried to read pretty much everyone's letters. I'm sorry that I had to abridge many of them, but you guys are verbose. I feel like I'm verbose, but
Y'all blow me away. So anyway, thanks again for writing in. Thank you, Shivam. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you for
this has
me.
Been Retronauts Micro, which of course you can find along with other episodes of Retronauts at retronauts.com, on iTunes, on the Podcast One Network, and through Patreon, which is how we're supported and can do this podcast and related ancillary projects full time. Go to patreon.com/retronauts and you can download episodes of the show a week in advance at a higher bit rate than they are released to the public with no ads. It's a very, very good deal. I think you should take us up on it. You won't regret it. Anyway, guys, where do we find you on the internet?
I'm Shivam Bhatt. You can find me on Twitter at Electrotal, E-L-E-K-T-R-O-T-A-L, and at my podcast, Commanderin, where I talk about Magic the Gathering every Wednesday, which is at CommanderinMTG.
Hey, it's Bob Mackey, and I am a full-time podmonger, and my other podcasts are Talking Simpsons, a chronological exploration of The Simpsons, and What a Cartoon. That is, we do a different cartoon of a different series every week, and you can find those on anywhere for free, any place you listen to podcasts. But I also have a Patreon that I do most of my living off of. That's the Talking Simpsons Patreon. Go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, and for the price of $5 a month, you can get all of our goodie bonus content for $5. That includes season one of Talking Simpsons, all of Talking Futurama. That's season one of Futurama. We do the Talking Simpsons treatment, Talking Critic interviews with Simpsons writers and showrunners and so much more. And I recommend you do the combo deal. You give to Retronauts for three, you give to Talking Simpsons for five. That is the price of your average burrito in America. And instead of eating a burrito, you can have all these podcasts just coming at you weekly, just unstoppable podcasts. So that's my suggestion. Go to –
it's healthier too.
It's very good. Yeah. Skip the burrito. The carbs are going to kill you anyways. But go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and we will get you out of the burrito lifestyle and into the podcasting lifestyle.
And I am Jeremy Parrish. You can find me living a carb-free existence at GameSpite on Twitter, mostly carb-free. I do like chocolate. Anyway, thanks everyone for writing in and thanks everyone else for listening. And we'll be back with a full-length extravaganza episode.